Welcome to the Conference for Women podcast, Invisible Influence, the Hidden Forces that Shape Our Behavior. Our guest today is Jonah Berger, a professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania and best-selling author of Contagious, Why Things Catch On, as well as Invisible Influence, the Hidden Forces that Shape Behavior. He has spent over 15 years studying how social influence works, what drives word of mouth, and how these factors combine to shape what becomes popular. In today's podcast, Jonah Berger will share ways you can be more influential and be better at motivating yourself and others. He'll talk about how to make smarter decisions and shape group opinion. You'll never look at your own behavior or the behavior of others the same way again. And a reminder, if you registered through Eventbrite, you will receive an email letting you know when the podcast is available online on your conference website. Now, Jonah Berger, welcome to the Conference for Women podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's a pleasure.
So today I'm going to talk a little bit about a subject that some of us know something about, but we often don't realize the full extent of, and that is influence and its invisible nature. And I was telling a friend of mine a few years ago that I was doing some research on social influence, and they're a lawyer in Washington, D.C., and they were lamenting the effect of influence on their peers. They were saying, God, you know, D.C. lawyers, they're all the same. You know, when they make partner, they make it big, sort of the first thing they do is they go out and they buy a new BMW to show that they've made it. And I said, wow, you know, that's really funny. That's interesting. But actually, to my friend, I said, you know, aren't you a D.C. lawyer? And they said, yeah. And I said, and don't you buy a BMW? Don't you drive a BMW? And they said, yeah, but everyone else drives gray ones, and I drive a blue one. And what I thought was so interesting about that story is two things. First, we do see influence sometimes. We see other people driving similar cars or kids all dressing the same. In fact, when we look around the world, there's only one place we never seem to see influence. And that is simply ourselves. We never realize how influence affects us, often because it's invisible, often because it happens non-consciously below our awareness. And second, there isn't just one flavor of influence. Sometimes we think about influences as imitation, as doing the same thing as others, and we think about that as a negative thing. But just as often, influence leads us to do the opposite thing from others. If we're at dinner, for example, and someone orders the entree we're thinking of getting, we might actually be less likely to get that entree, avoid it, pick something else, which makes us actually less happy, because we don't want to be the same as them. And so when does social influence lead us to do the same thing as others? When does it lead us to do something different? When does it motivate us to take action? When does it demotivate us? And how, by understanding this science, can we live happier and healthier lives and be more successful both at home and at work? And so what I'll do today is share two tips to harness invisible influence, two tips from the book to begin to think about these ideas. And they're kind of disparate tips, but they'll be helpful to think about the principles and also how you can use them. And so the first, very simply, is to be a chameleon. And let me tell you a little bit about what I mean. We all would probably like to be influential, or at least a little bit more influential. Who wouldn't want to have a bigger impact at work, changing the client's mind or getting the boss to follow our advice? And at home, who wouldn't like to get the kids to eat more vegetables, for example, or to get the neighbors to trim their hedges finally? But how can we be more persuasive? How can we use the tools of influence to be more influential ourselves? Well, some researchers looked at this question, and they looked at it in one of the most unlikely of places, negotiating. Now, if most of you are like me, you probably hate negotiating. I do not like negotiating at all. I never know what price to name. I don't want to turn people off. I want to be fair at the same time. I want to get a good deal from my end. It seems like we're working together, but it often seems like we're competing at the same time. And so how can we all be better at negotiations, be more successful, particularly when deals look hard to make? So they studied a particular negotiation. They took a bunch of students, and they put them in one of two roles. In one role was a guy named Justin, and he owned a gas station. And he was interested in selling that gas station. And Susan was in the role of the gas station buyer. She represented a large conglomerate that was buying up a number of gas stations. And both of them were trying to reach a deal. And so Justin threw out one number, Susan threw out another, Justin threw out a second number, Susan threw out a second, but it didn't look like there was any agreement possible. The highest number or the lowest number that Justin was willing to accept was much higher than the number that Susan was willing to give. And what this is called is the zone of potential agreement. In any negotiation, there's a zone where agreement can be reached. If you're buying a house, for example, and you're willing to bid up to $1 million, and the seller is willing to go as low as $800,000, well, you've got a nice zone of potential agreement. Anywhere between $800,000 and $1 million, you'll reach a deal. But in other negotiations, that zone is much smaller. If the most you're willing to pay is $1 million and the least the seller is willing to go is $999,000, well, there's only a much smaller room to reach a deal. Well, in this particular negotiation, the gas station negotiation, it looked like a deal would not be able to be made. There was no gap between the number that Justin was willing to do and the number that Susan was willing to do. It looked like an unfair situation, no way for a deal to be reached. But actually, if you thought about it, there was a way. And what it required the sides doing is trusting each other. In most negotiations, it's not just about price. At the end of the day, it's not just about the number that you're reaching. There are often other dimensions that are important. And this negotiation was no different. Justin's gas station owner, for example, actually wanted to sell the station so he could go travel a trip around the world. But he wanted, when he came back, to have a good job to come back to when he finished his trip. Susan, the person buying the gas station for that large conglomerate, well, she didn't just want to buy the station. She actually needed someone to operate it in the long term. And so there was another dimension on which they could agree, another dimensional way to reach this deal. But to do that, they had to trust each other. And that's the least thing that most people want to do in a one-off negotiation. They want to extract the most value. They don't want to trust each other. So how could they trust each other in this tough one-off negotiation? Well, researchers looked at hundreds of payers playing this negotiation. They found a simple trick led negotiators to be five times as successful, five times more likely to reach a deal when all looked like it was lost. And that trick, as we were discussing, came from the animal kingdom. If we think about it, chameleons are amazing animals, but what we tend to know them for is blending in with their surroundings. The notion is that chameleons change color to fit in with their environment. If they're on one leaf, they're a different color than on if they're a completely different colored leaf. Well, it turns out that chameleons aren't the only creature that changes their skin or their being to fit the environment. It turns out that humans do the same thing. If you're sitting next to someone who touches their eye, for example, you're more likely to do the same. Or if you're sitting next to someone that puts their hand on their chin, you're more likely to do the same. We non-consciously mimic the behavior, the mannerisms, even the language of others around us. And this comes from a very basic developmental place. If you think about it, when children are born, right, they're born into a world they don't understand how to do anything. They're born into this world where everything is new. It's like being dropped off in a foreign city. You don't know the language. You can't go anywhere. You can't read any of the signs. And in fact, you can't even control your limbs. It's tough as a baby to learn. Well, there's things in our mind called mirror neurons that make that easier. If you pick up a cup, for example, these mirror neurons in your mind, they fire. They go off. But it turns out it's not just when you pick up the cup. Actually, if you see someone else picking up that cup, the same mirror neurons fire in your mind. And so the mere act of seeing someone else doing something makes it more easy for us to do that same thing. It potentiates or facilitates that action. It allows us to do the same. And that idea of mimicry or mirror neurons enables learning in children. Well, it turns out it doesn't just enable learning, it allows us to be more influential. We can apply this idea of mimicry to be more successful. That trick that led negotiators to be five times as successful was simply mirroring or mimicking the behavior of others around them. If those negotiators, for example, saw their peer, the person they were negotiating with, lean back in their chair, well, they subtly did the same. They saw that peer sort of scratching their head or thinking deeply for a moment, they did the same. Not obviously, but subtly mimicking the behavior, the language, or the actions of others led negotiators to be five times as successful. And it's not just negotiators. In a sales context, for example, waiters and waitresses who mimic customers' orders got 70% higher tips. If you're at a restaurant and you'd say, you know, I'd like the Brussels burger, medium rare, with bacon, a side salad, and a Diet Coke, well, the waiter or waitress could say many different things back. But if they say back to you word for word exactly what you said, a Brussels burger, medium rare, with bacon, a side salad, and a Diet Coke, well, they just got a much larger tip. And the reason, very simply, is that mimicry creates a sense of trust and affiliation. It's like if we're talking, we find out that we have the same birthday in common or we're from the same town. Suddenly we feel a kinship. We don't feel like we're two disparate sides. We're merely acquaintances or strangers. We feel like we have something in common. We're more similar, more familiar, and so we're more likely to get along. It's not just in a business context either. Daters, for example, who are on a first date, if their language matches each one another more, the way they talk matches up better, well, they're more likely to go on a second date. And it turns out even couples, the longer they've been married, their faces come to look alike by mimicking or mirroring each other's facial expressions, smiling when their partner smiles or frowning when their partner smiles, frowning when their partner frowns, I'm sorry. And so what does this mean for us for applying these ideas? Well, very simply, first of all, don't just listen, emulate, right? It's good to listen in a negotiation or when talking to a client or when talking to that neighbor, but don't just listen, emulate their behavior as well. Mimic them or imitate what they're doing. In some contexts, for example, eating the same food as someone else led them to be faster to reach a negotiated outcome or trust someone investing their money more, simply because they ate the same thing. Right? Eating the same thing made them feel like they had more in common, made them more likely to then reach a deal. Or over an online context, for example, someone sends you an email using a dear versus a hi versus a hey in the first line of their note. Well, mimicking that word for word back for them, if they say dear, you say dear. If they say hey, you say hey. Not just listening, but emulating the way they're approaching that situation will make them more likely to do the same as you. Mimicry will increase trust, liking, and affiliation. It will turn strangers into allies and acquaintances into friends, and it'll make you much more likely to be persuasive. So that's tip number one, being a chameleon. Let me share just one more before we go to questions, and that is the power of proximal peers. Now, motivation is always a tough thing, whether we're trying to motivate ourselves to lose weight or exercise more, where they're trying to motivate others in a work context, for example. How can we motivate people to work harder or put in extra hours? Or at home, how can we motivate our kids, for example, to do their homework faster or read that extra book? How can we motivate people to take action? Well, too often there are two tactics that are used, a carrot and a stick. The carrot being just to pay people money. We assume, well, if we pay them more money, they'll be more likely to do something. And the stick is if we punish them. We say, oh, if you don't do it, you're going to be in trouble. But those things don't always work effectively. Is there a better way to motivate people? So some scientists looked into this in the domain of energy usage. They wanted people to save more energy. So they went door to door in a small town in California and used different appeals to see which one was more effective. Some people, they knocked on their door and they said, hey, saving energy is good because it'll help you save money. You turn on fans, you turn down your air conditioning, your heat, you'll save money on your bill, and that'll be a good thing. Saving money will help you in the long run. That was one appeal. Another appeal, rather than saving money, focused on being a good citizen. Turning down your heating or turning down your air conditioning, turning on your fan in the summer, that'll make you a good citizen. And a third appeal focused on saving the environment. Do those same actions, turning on that fan, turning down the heat or the air conditioning will make you a good citizen. People liked these appeals, and when the researchers asked them, will you change your behavior, people said, sure, definitely. And those appeals are great. I'll definitely change my behavior. But they didn't just look what people said they did. They also looked at what people actually did. Without the people realizing, they came back later on and they measured their energy use over time. And what they found was quite surprising. People thought that certain appeals would be very effective, maybe a little more effective than the others, but actually, unfortunately, none of them were effective. None of the appeals led to any energy change. It was almost like the researchers hadn't knocked on those doors at all in the first place. People said they would change their behavior, but they didn't. Well, it turns out, though, that there was a fourth appeal that actually was effective. And it wasn't about saving money, wasn't about being a good citizen, and it wasn't about saving the environment. It was very simply telling people, you know what? Your neighbors are saving energy. Your neighbors are turning on fans, turning down their heater in the winter, and turning down their air conditioning in the summer. Your neighbors are saving energy. You might want to think about it as well. Telling people their neighbors were doing it made them do the same thing. It turns out that peers are a powerful motivating source, a powerful way to motivate ourselves and others. If we think about energy use for a moment, most of us have no idea how much energy we're using every month. Sure, we might get a bill in the mail and that bill has a certain price on it, but we have no idea whether that's a lot of energy or not a lot. We have no standard to compare ourselves to. Is 2,000 kilowatt hours a lot or a little? I have no clue. And if I have no clue, I'm going to be unlikely to change my behavior. But rather than sending people a bill with just their energy usage, a company called Opower has built a billion-dollar business model on comparing people to others. Rather than simply saying this is how much energy you used, they say this is how much energy you used, and this is how much energy someone in your neighborhood used as well. Someone who has a similar size home to you, similar size reason for energy use, they use this much energy. Well, by comparing themselves to their neighbors, people are motivated to start using less energy themselves. The amount of energy saved is as much as taking Alaska and Hawaii off the grid for a year, a huge amount of energy, or taking all the cars off the road in Chicago for an entire year. That's how much carbon is saved simply through these simple energy bills by comparing people to others. Peers are a much more motivating force than just money and the carrot or the stick. But you might be saying to yourself, great, okay, comparing ourselves to others, but who should I compare myself to? Are all comparisons motivating, or are certain comparisons more effective than others? And we actually looked at this in an interesting context. We looked at professional basketball. If there's anyone who should already be motivated, who shouldn't need peers to compare themselves to be motivated, it should be professional basketball players. They make tens of millions of dollars a year based on their personal performance and how well their teams do. There shouldn't be any reason then that comparing themselves to their peers should be motivating. But we looked at whether it would actually be. We looked at the score at halftime of over tens of thousands of NBA games and NCAA games, the score at halftime and the score at the end of the game, to see whether how people were doing relative to their peers affected motivation. And we found something interesting. If you're a betting man or woman, it turns out that, not surprisingly, the higher a team is ahead, the more likely they are to win. So if a team is up by 2 points at halftime rather than 0 points, or 4 points rather than 2 points, they'll be more likely to win, about 8% more likely to win for every 2 points they are ahead. And so that makes sense. But it turns out that there's one place where being behind is actually a good thing. Teams that are behind by 1 point, you would expect them to be more likely to lose. They're behind, and they tend to be worse teams on average, but they were actually more likely to win. Why? Because being behind by just a little bit is motivating. They were so close they could almost taste it, and those teams came fired out in the second half and were more likely to win. They wanted to close that gap. And so not all comparisons are motivating. If you're too far behind, a team that's 20 or 25 points behind, they might give up. They might say, there's no way for me to win, so I'm going to give up. Same thing happens in schools, right? We name a valedictorian, or we compare students to the best child in the class, but all the kids that are far behind are going to say, there's no way I'm going to do as well as that kid, so I'll probably give up. Comparisons are only good if we compare ourselves to proximal peers, or those who are doing just a little bit better than us. So when we're comparing our kids, for example, to others, we want to tell them they're doing well, but compare them to someone else that might be doing just a little bit better. Right? Or we're trying to get ourselves to lose weight or run faster. Well, we want to compare ourselves to someone else, but not anyone else, someone who's doing just a little bit better than we are. If we're going out for a run, for example, well, don't go out for a run with someone who's much faster than we are, but also don't go out for a run alone. Right? Going out for a run with someone who's just a little bit faster than us will encourage us to run faster because we want to close that gap. Right? We want to do better because our competitive juices get flowing. And so in a work context, for example, don't name just one person employee of the month, for example, or don't compare someone to someone in the organization who's doing way better than them. Compare them to someone else who's doing just a little bit better than them. Or even don't make the comparison. You know, post scores, but post scores that tell them how they're doing just compared to others slightly better than them. In golf, for example, they use something called flighting, where they don't compare people to everybody else. They compare people to the golfers just ahead of them. And so at the end of the day, very simply, if you want someone to win, tell them they're losing, but just by a little bit. Proximal peers are a great way to motivate us, and use peers to help motivate others. Well, those very simply are two tricks from Invisible Influence to help us be more influential and to motivate ourselves and others. And importantly, social influence, it's not just about imitation. Right? We talked a little bit about imitation, but there are other cases where we differentiate ourselves. And in a sense, social influence is like a magnet. Sometimes it attracts and sometimes it repels. But by understanding how influence works, by spotting it in the world around us, we can live happier and healthier lives. We can influence others. We can reach our own goals and help others do the same. Right? By understanding influence, we can take advantage of its power. We can take advantage of its upsides and avoid its downsides. Influence may often be invisible, but by seeing it more, we can be more successful. Well, I hope you found these two tips useful. I hope you enjoy the book. And now we'll talk a little bit about a broader set of questions about these ideas and how you can use them.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Jonah, could you talk a little bit about how you first became interested in how and why people make decisions? How did this body of research start?
You know, it's funny. I've always been interested in human behavior. looking around at people around us. And it's interesting to introspect and think about why we do the things we do. I think we've all had some of these experiences. You know, we've all bought something similar to something someone else bought, or had someone else buy something similar to what we bought. And sometimes we have a reaction to that, right? We might have felt angry that someone else bought the same thing we did, or we might feel happy that they bought the same thing so we can be part of a club together. But sometimes we don't necessarily understand how that influence works. And so I've always been excited to apply these tools, the tools of hard science, of experimentation and data and statistics, to help us understand why we do the things that we do. There's some great tools out there that can help us live better lives. You know, we don't just have to fall prey to influence. We can take advantage of it. We can choose our influence to be more influential, to motivate ourselves and others, to make better decisions, both in groups and by ourselves. But to do that, we have to understand how influence works.
Got it. Now, one of your tips was be a chameleon. And you write that people who mimic their negotiating partner are 5 times as likely to find a successful outcome because it creates, as you put it, trust and affiliation between the negotiating partners. So does that mean if I'm in a negotiation, I should watch what my partner is doing and mimic their behavior or play back their words? Or is this something that has to happen on a subconscious level?
So a great question. And 2 things are important to realize. First, we do this all the time non-consciously. The mere fact that you and I are talking, for example, we're already changing our language patterns a little bit based on hearing each other talk. We do this all the time, even without realizing it. That said, we can take advantage of this to influence others, but only if others are not aware of it occurring. Right? If we do exactly what someone else is doing every time they do it and they're aware of it, they might be a little bit upset. But if once in a while we subtly do something similar to what they're doing, they are not going to realize it and will be more persuasive. Politicians, for example, when they visit different areas of the country, they often take on different language features or linguistic tics, mm-hmm. Different accents to make their constituents in an area feel like they're more similar to them. And that's exactly what we want to do. We don't want to do everything our negotiating partner's doing or do everything the client is doing. It might make them upset, but mimicking them a little bit or making them feel like we have something in common, right? It's not necessarily even mimicry, just mimicry, making us feel a kinship, making them feel more similar, pointing out similarities. If we're both from the same town, if we have a similar handbag, if we like a similar sports team, if we're eating a similar sandwich for lunch, highlighting those similarities will make us feel like they have more in common with us and lead to better outcomes at the end of the day.
Okay. Now, your second tip was what you called the power of proximal peers. And I found it fascinating that people were motivated in saving energy to keep up with the Joneses, as it were, to keep up with their neighbors, that was a more potent argument than saving money or being a good citizen or saving the environment. Where else do we see this power of proximal peers? How does it play out in our daily lives?
You know, it's hard to find an area where this isn't playing out in our daily lives. If you think about it in a meeting, for example, you know, if someone else who was hired at the same time as us makes a good comment, we feel competitive, right? We feel like, you know, they said something good, I should say something good as well. If our kids are in class, you know, they're constantly thinking about how they're doing relative to their classmates. Or if they play soccer, they're thinking of how they're doing relative to their teammates or members of the other team. All I'm pointing out here is how we can take advantage of that, right? How we can use that idea, those comparisons, and highlight them to encourage people to do the right thing. You know, for example, if we know that our kids idolize a certain person or, you know, tend to compare themselves or have a friend, you know, point out that person eats their vegetables, right, or does something desirable. Point out, you know, someone in their lives who does that thing we want them to do, they'll be more likely to do it. It's highlighting, in some sense, the proximal peers or things that might be happening already. Or in a work context, when we're trying to motivate employees, again, don't focus on the person at the top of the pyramid. Focus on someone just better than them. If you have a performance review and you say, look, you know, the average employee is doing 60 calls a month and you're only doing 30, that person's going to say, man, there's no way for me to catch up. I'm really far behind. So don't focus on the average. Say, look, you know, you're doing 30, but there's someone else in your group that's doing 35. You don't even have to name them necessarily. Just point out that someone else like them with similar characteristics is doing slightly better, not much better, but slightly better, and they'll feel like they can do it as well.
Got it. Now, how can social influences, if they are so prevalent, how do they go unnoticed by us and remain invisible, as you say?
Well, influence often happens non-consciously, without our awareness. Take the simplest, almost the simplest decision we make, how to name children. So as anyone who's named their child can attest to, you pick a name based on your personal preferences, right? I mean, your likes and dislikes, a name sounds good or bad to you. It's named after your uncle or your aunt or a friend of yours that you grew up with. And yet, when your kid gets to first or second grade, there are two or three other kids with the same name and six or seven who have a similar sounding name. How is it that when we're trying to be different, that we all have these personal preferences, we end up in the same place? Well, it turns out without realizing it, other names that are popular at that time are shaping our choices. So take the name Karen, for example. Well, the popularity of Karen affects whether Karen is popular, but the popularity of other names that begin with K, like Katie and Catherine and even Carl that starts with the same sound, even though it's actually a different letter, affect the popularity of that name. Without realizing it, hearing names more often make their sounds sound better. And makes us like them more. Even hurricanes, for example. After Hurricane Katrina, baby names that began with the letter K increased by 10%. Now you'd say, no one would want to name their kid after Hurricane Katrina. Why would anyone pick that name? Well, they weren't picking that name per se. They were picking other names that began with the same sound. Without realizing it, merely hearing Katrina more often made K sound better and made people more likely to pick related names.
Wow, that is fascinating. Can you tell us more, Jonah, about how influence helps shape innovation? For example, the transition from the horse and buggy to the automobile.
Yeah, so one thing we didn't talk as much about is launching new products and ideas. Mm-hmm. So thinking about, you know, the best way to launch new products or ideas. And we tend to have intuition that it's good to be different, right? Think different, right? I mean, isn't that why Steve Jobs and Apple succeeded? Isn't that why Google was successful? Because they were different from everybody else? But actually, that's not correct. If you look at who ends up succeeding, it's usually not the first entrant to the market. It's usually the second, third, or even the fourth or fifth. Someone who comes in later ends up being more successful. Someone who is not different, but actually was doing what everyone else was already doing. And in fact, even thinking about companies like Google, they didn't succeed in an area they were first in. They succeeded in online search after AltaVista and Yahoo and a number of other companies were already in that space. So it's not about being different. What is it about? And it turns out that it's about being something called optimally distinct. And that example, as you mentioned, it's good to think back to when the automobile was introduced. When the automobile first came out, it was quite different from what people were used to. At the time, everyone was driving around in horses and buggies. That was what people were used to. And the automobile, something that mobilized itself without a horse, was scary. People in rural areas called it the devil's work. And horses got scared when it pulled up next to them at the stop sign because they couldn't figure out how it was moving without a horse. The impediments to adoption weren't functional. They were psychological. How could people be more comfortable with adopting this new idea? So a guy named Uzziah Smith came up with a new innovation to help people adopt it. And it wasn't about being different. The automobile already was different. It was about being similar. What he did is he came out with something called the horsey horseless that looked like an automobile, except it had a fake horse head on the front. Literally a fake-looking horse head on the front of the car. Why? To make people feel more comfortable, to make it look like something they had seen before. Now, you might laugh and you might think this ridiculous, but what it did is it made this new thing feel more familiar by making it similar to what we already knew. And it's not just them, right? Think about Chobani Greek yogurt. Chobani's been hugely successful in launching Greek yogurt to the United States. And you might think, well, that's because they were first to market, but they weren't. They actually came in 10 years after the market leader, the best Greek yogurt in Greece, Faye, had come to the U.S. So why did they succeed? Well, it wasn't about being different. It was actually being similar and different at the same time. Rather than focusing on how different they were, they made yogurt in similar-looking containers, single size rather than family size, single size container with fruit at the bottom, just like most American consumers are used to, similar rather than different. And so it's all about being optimally distinct or similar but different at the same time. Too different and it's scary. Too similar, if it's exactly the same as what's being done already, there's no reason to change. But right in the middle, sort of like a Goldilocks effect, if you will, similar and different at the same time, it's going to be more likely to be successful.
Great. Jonah, we have time for one more question, and I'm going to make it a rather provocative one, and that is, does your research suggest that we're all kind of mindless mass following the rest of the crowd, or is there room here for individuality and independence?
You know, I think what the more interesting question is actually, why do we think that following others is bad? We have this notion that, you know, being like others is bad. We're not all exactly the same. We don't all look identical, but we do, and we are influenced by our peers, our friends, and our family. You know, we buy the same car as our neighbors. We vote the same politically as our parents often, or our friends. Sure, we're similar, but we're different at the same time as well. We're not identical to others. We mix and match those influences. And so I think in so doing, we find our own path. It's not bad to be influenced by others. Others help us make smarter, faster, and easier decisions. And at the same time, they allow us to fit into the group. If we were different from everybody else, we wouldn't be very happy. And so invisible influence is all about understanding how influence works and using similarity and difference to be successful.
Wonderful. That is all we have time for today. Our thanks to Jonah Berger, professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania and author of Invisible Influence, The Hidden Forces That Shape Our Behavior. You can hear Jonah Berger at the Pennsylvania Conference for Women in Philadelphia on October 6th. Register at paconferenceforwomen.org. Thank you.